You're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Chef Michael Solomonoff and his partner, Steve Cook, the duo behind Philadelphia's beloved Zahav Restaurant and Dizengoff and Federal Donuts and Percy Street Barbecue and Abe Fisher. They stopped by the studio a couple weeks back, and they brought with them freshly made hummus and warm pita hot out the oven. And for that, I am eternally grateful. All right, Mike, first question. I have no idea where the accents in your last name go.
So, all right, I know. It's, you know, if you were in Israel, you would say Solomonov. But here, people say Solomonov or Solomonov or Solomonov, or they just forget about the OV and say Solomon.
Solomon, yeah, easier. Or Mike Solo.
Mike Solo, actually, is what everyone calls me, yeah.
And Steve Cook, what about you? How do you pronounce your last name?
It's pretty straightforward, yeah. My favorite pronunciation of Mike's name is Solomonov.
I was thinking about that. I'm like, maybe it's like that. I don't know. Like, yeah.
There's slightly fewer ways to pronounce Zahav than Mike's last name.
So you're business partners and Cook Solo. Do we call that a restaurant and hospitality group, or...?
Yeah, I guess we don't. We haven't come up with any of those, like, you know, colon. This is what it is, but
just
that's
kind of
what we do.
Yeah.
All right. So we here in New York are fired up because you finally opened Dizengoff in the Chelsea Market here in New York, and you brought some with you for me and us. I'm going to open it up right now. Dizengoff, I hate to say this, but do we call it a hummuseria, or what do you guys call it?
Hummusia.
So hummus. If you're the guy who's just like talking regular, will you then throw in the Israeli accent when you say hummus?
No, because it sounds like then I'm like one of those like anchor people that like whenever they see something like a Spanish
burrito
country,
yes,
they're like Nicaragua, and I'm like, you don't talk like that.
So when you're talking to white guys,
I'll say
like
hummus
us, what
because
say?
I'll be like, yeah, it's a hummus place or a hummus restaurant or whatever, or I'll say hummusia, and then when people say hummusaria, I don't correct them.
All right, I'm opening up as we go. All right, so we did a page on this in the magazine last year as our sort of dish of the year, and we shot a bunch of hummus.
Yeah, you got it.
Whatever, plural, at your joint last year with all sorts of beautiful toppings and bright arrays of color. Let's talk, can I make good hummus at home, or is that possible?
100%, you can make good hummus at home. In my opinion, what you need are really good chickpeas and good tahina. Or tahini, or tahina. Tahina.
I'm opening up the pita. Wow, that's beautiful homemade-looking pita there.
Sure is.
All right, so, when you say good chickpeas, what does that mean? Not from a can.
No, actually, I think that we found that, like, you can get really good organic canned chickpeas.
Oh, you
and
can?
Sometimes
okay.
Those are easier.
I'm going in
please
right here.
Dip. Yeah, please dip. Please, wipe it up.
The way you dip.
You can get really good dried chickpeas, but if you go to a place that doesn't sell a lot of dried stuff, or if you go to a place that isn't that reputable, you know, like maybe a slower corner store or something, you don't know how long the dried chickpeas have been around for, right? And I think that sometimes that it's just easier to find the good canned ones, but you just want to make sure the chickpeas are really soft. So if you cook them yourself, we use baking soda to loosen the skins.
When do you put in the baking soda? And explain that to me.
We soak them with water and baking soda, and then we drain them. We soak it overnight, and then we add it to a pot with more water and more baking soda and cook it. And that really breaks down. Steve, what does it do? You know, like, exactly what it does?
It allows the water to penetrate through the skin of the chickpea, I think, a little bit easier and break it down a little bit.
When you have good hummus, like just how creamy and flavorful, but not overly flavorful. Yeah. So what do you do next?
Well, so that it's a good point that you bring up because, like, so many different countries and cultures like have their own version of hummus, and in my opinion, Israeli and Palestinian hummus is about the tahina. That's just sesame paste, right? And we get ours from a company called Sum, which means sesame in Hebrew, and it's processed in Nazareth, but the seeds come from Ethiopia, which is where the better sesame seeds come from in the world. I always thought that sesame was grown in Israel, but it's too, you know, there's not enough of the country, and you need a little bit more water and stuff. So what we do is we take our tahina and we aerate it, and we like whip it with ice water and garlic and lemon, but not too much.
What do you mean you whip it with ice water?
Well, what you do, the thing with sesame paste is that it tightens up if you just like mix it, right? So a lot of people take chickpeas and garlic and lemon and sesame and just throw it into like a food processor. Mm-hmm. And they buzz it, and then inevitably it tightens up and it turns into like peanut butter. And then you have to put in more garlic or more lemon or more water or oil or whatever to get it to the right consistency. And we found that if you process the tchina, which is actually a basis because we don't use a lot of dairy in our restaurant, mm-hmm. particularly when we're garnishing like meat or whatever or vegetables. So what we do is have this base tchina sauce, which is aerated. It doesn't get stuck to the roof of your mouth.
Yeah, I find really that sometimes creamy. When you buy the store-bought hummus, the less good ones, it's almost like mortar that you're spreading on bricks.
It's not,
you know?
It's not good. It's not, yeah. It's not light, and it's not really creamy. Exactly. And we found that the our version of Israeli hummus is really, really creamy.
And then in terms of the lemon juice or garlic or that sort of stuff, how potent do you want it to be or not?
You want it to be balanced, but I don't think that you should have like raw garlic on your breath when you're mm-hmm. done eating it. And I don't think it should be so acidic that it hurts your stomach when you eat it, you know?
I imagine there are people out there with hummus opinions who like to share them with you.
Every single person that eats hummus, I think, has a hummus opinion. And, you know, this is our interpretation of it. We're not a hummusia in Israel.
Are you trying to say there's a few opinionated Jews out there?
What do they say? Four Jews, five opinions, right? So, but I think that's for everybody. That's just people eating. That's not. It's not just Israelis. It's not just Jews. It's not just people. It's not just Arabs. It's like everybody just has an opinion about food. And I think that food is so global right now. You know, you have people that are coming in and pronouncing hummus the right way.
Yeah.
You know, and you have people that I don't know. It's just
what's interesting
cool.
about it's always those sort of iconic foods that people have an opinion on. They're not going to have an opinion on some very high concept-y sort of dish you created, but it's like pizza, hummus. Like there are certain things that everyone shares that they feel belongs to them as, you know, it's kind of communal.
I mean, I think it's like making hummus, it's a few ingredients. It's the simple things that are hard, and therefore I think that's why, you know, everybody, some people like a little more lemon, a little more garlic, and they, you know, and it's also the first hummus I ate was like, that's what sets the standard.
Yeah.
For you personally.
We have this beautiful spread in front of us right now. We have two cups of hummus, one with just like a little sort of chili sort of oil, sumac. What's the one there?
Paprika and oil.
Then we had another one which looks like some sort of avocado situation going on in there.
I think it's – is that a pea
or
situation?
Is that a fava bean paste?
I think it might be a fava bean situation.
A fava bean mash.
Potentially.
And then we got a bunch of chopped like – cucumbers with pickled onions. We've got some. Is that like cabbage? Is that like a baba ganoush sort of situation over there?
Yeah, it's a baba ganoush situation.
And what's going on here? This dark red stuff.
That's muhammara. It's like the pepper and walnut pomegranate situation.
Okay, cool. And then we got a couple of hot sauces. One, the green one. Talk to this. I imagine this is like the cilantro hot sauce.
Yeah, go ahead, say it. I know you're dying.
I don't know how to say it. I love this stuff.
You're gonna love it.
I don't even know what it's called.
Shug was brought to Israel by the Yemeni Jews.
Okay.
And then this is harif or harissa, mm-hmm. which is what we okay. like the red pepper situation.
Yep.
It's got some spices too. Not just like heat, but also spices. And this, the shug, the green chili, came like from the east, you know?
Well, it's amazing all that when you really look at the travels and the spice travels and what sort of migrates food-wise from country to country.
Well, you see it all. The thing is like on the Israeli table, you see all of it in one place.
Yeah.
And shug came to Israel in the 50s and 60s and is now on every single table. You get hot sauce. It's either that or the red, you know?
Zahav, do you call it an Israeli restaurant? Do you call it a Middle Eastern restaurant?
We call it Israeli, and a lot of people are like, you know, the thing is, it's the same thing with our cookbook. It's the same thing with calling anything Israeli. If you look at the way that all of this food got to the table in Israel, you understand what Israel is sort of about or what makes it up, right? It's groups of people that left Israel mm-hmm. for the diaspora and then eventually started coming back. And are still continuing to migrate back, right?
It's interesting is you have people who basically came from Eastern Europe who came back and then sort of were introduced to this cuisine again or reintroduced.
Exactly. But at that same time, like so my grandparents came from Bulgaria, right? They were from Spain like in the post-Inquisition. And they went to Bulgaria and then the Bulgarians were conquered by the Ottomans, which brought with them like kofta, kebab, feta, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then the Bulgarians overthrew the Ottomans, and then there was the war, like the Second World War, and then they were in labor camps, and then they ended up immigrating to Israel. So with them, they bring food from Spain, from ancient Spain, from Turkey, right, because the Ottomans conquered it for so long, and then plus Balkan food. And it's like every single person in that country has got some sort of trail that goes back to wherever. So, you can't argue with those things. I mean, my family's ancestry and history is what it was for whatever, however they got to where they are.
How do you integrate yourself into this food relationship with Israel, with this type of food cuisine? Do you sort of opine, or do you to Mike, or you're like, oh, that's not my place, Mike? You call the shots.
I mean, I've learned a lot from Mike over the years. I mean, I grew up in a Jewish household, you know, where Israel played an important role, and so it's not unfamiliar to me, and I had my own memories of the food. But, I mean, I've learned a lot more through Mike's eyes about where the food came from and what makes up the cuisine.
The first restaurant after Zahav you opened, or did you do Federal Donuts after that? Or
no, it was a barbecue.
Barbecue, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And you got a fried chicken donuts place, and then Dizengoff finally came at.
Right. Well, we were terrified that doing a hummus only concept was gonna kill Zahav.
Oh, really?
Because we were like, the only reason people want to come to Zahav at all is for the hummus. So if they can just get that by itself, why would they ever come back to Zahav? So it took us a while to get over that fear, and it hasn't materialized, fortunately.
Yeah, and so what convinced you to be like, hey, this is okay, we can do this?
I don't usually like kind of like boredom and getting ready, you know, feeling like we're ready to do the next thing. I think is what has driven a lot of our seemingly random decisions.
All right, so I went on this eating crawl in Philly for our travel issue, which was our May issue, and I spent 32 hours there with my former assistant Emil Stonick, who you know because he used to work at a bar called 12 Steps. Yeah. In Philly, where you have some background with, right, Mike?
I mean, back when I drank, I used to be a barfly there.
It is one of those types of bars where you can be a barfly.
I lived across the street, actually, years and years. So it was I haven't been there in, you know, 8 years or something. But so I knew Emil from there. And I actually, when we opened Zahav, it took so long for us to open that we had all these people that we had, like, sort of hired. And we didn't have a job for them, obviously, but we wanted to retain them. So I got the owner of 12 Steps to employ them as cooks and as line cooks, and we redid their menu. And that was sort of like the trade-off. And I probably got some free drinks out of it as well at the time. But so
it's actually a sizable kitchen at the bar. Your Pabst Blue Ribbon beer battered chicken fingers are still on the menu, correct?
Those are really after all good. These years. Yeah. Those are really good.
Explain to me the lamb shoulder.
So the lamb is
it a shoulder?
It's a shoulder, yeah. And we brine it, and then we smoke it, and then we braise it in pomegranate juice with chickpeas.
Does it get crispy somehow?
Well, we do. We glaze it then in the oven, so it gets kind of like dark, and it gets like a bark a little bit.
It's like a giant Israeli General Cho's nugget.
We didn't call that on the menu because we thought it would be too confusing. But and then we serve with it Persian rice, which has like the crust called tariq. You know, so we serve like a little pot of rice upside down.
So I had heard about Federal Donuts, and I'm like, okay, wait, this place only sells donuts and fried chicken, and I was like, that's kind of genius, like just deep fry everything. And so we walked in. This one was. Well, a couple of things. I want to ask you about the concept and how you decided to open, where you opened, and all that. But they sent out a basket of freshly fried cake donuts in different sugars, like a cinnamon sugar, and like was there a strawberry lavender sugar or something?
Strawberry and then vanilla, right?
Spice. Yes. Yep. Yeah. You cannot not finish a warm cake donut dusted in sugar. So I think I had three of those.
I know. Whenever you're like, man, I don't want a donut. And then you're like, oh, I'll take a little bite. And then you're like, I just ate a whole donut.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, first of all, you smell them. You get that smell. And then they're crispy on the outside. And they're almost still sort of like moist and molten on the inside.
Yeah.
And you're going to like, I'm going to have half of this. And then, of course, you eat the whole thing. And then I'm like, all right, we're good with that. And then out comes this fried the ranch dusted fried chicken sandwich with American – what's the cheese and sauce situation?
It's American cheese, Cooper Sharp American, and spicy mayonnaise and some pickles.
On like a squishy potato roll.
On a Martin's potato roll.
And I was just like, oh, my God. Like I can't not eat the whole thing of that. So it's like 4 in the afternoon, and I've just had three donuts and an entire fried chicken sandwich, and I wasn't even hungry.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how we do it.
So how did that idea come about? I assume, like I said, you said you stopped drinking a while ago, so you weren't drunk when you had this idea. Like, where did this idea come from?
We owned a restaurant next to these guys who had a coffee shop, and they were like, you got to check out this like really nasty old cheesesteak shop that closed down across the street from my house. And I was like, no way. So Mike goes down there. He comes back and he's like, you got to check this out. So they wanted to do a coffee shop and they wanted help with the food. So they asked us, and they had already thought of the idea of donuts.
Yeah, they owned a coffee shop called Bodhi that like was, they were the first to bring like single origin coffee to Philly, yes. Basically.
So they said, you guys want to do a donut shop? We said, sure. And then one of our, you know, and it cost like nothing to open. It was just I never thought it would amount to anything. It would just be a little fun side project. But somewhere along the lines in planning, we were wondering how late we were going to be open and what we were going to do in the afternoons and whether we could use the fryers from the donuts to fry anything else. And that was when I think Mike had the idea, suggested fried chicken.
So, yeah, I think at the time we were like eating, I was eating like a lot of Korean fried chicken wings, but there's a, in Cheltenham, which you didn't get to on your trip, but it's like a neighborhood north kind of a Philly. There's a huge Korean population, and there's like a really good chicken wing place called Soho Cafe. And it is like incinerates your mouth. It's so spicy, but so good. And they serve food till 1 a.m., which is a good thing. So we were like, oh, we'll do chicken too. So the guys had the coffee and the donuts sort of planned out. Our fifth partner, Felicia, is big into social media. Steve and I know how to cook. And we put in just like a little bit of money. I think this is right after we opened Percy Street. So we had these two, Zahav and Percy Street. And it was like we had these big restaurants and we were just like kind of done with that. And we opened Bobby, who's one of our partners, built the restaurant by hand.
And which branch was this? I went to the one kind of like near the project, sort of.
Yeah, that was the last one. That was the last one to open.
Okay,
you went to the one with seating and
parking.
Yeah,
seating, parking,
projects,
running water.
By the way, we don't fry the chicken and the donuts in the same fryers. That's a common. Oh. That's a very common. That's like the number one question we get.
I would have thought that's why the donuts taste so good, like chicken fat.
Some people don't like that.
Some people.
You should be able to order the special chicken fat donuts.
The off menu. Yeah,
that'd be pretty cool, actually.
Yeah.
So one thing I thought was interesting when I walked in, there was almost that sort of like Bad News Bears after the soft baseball game. You go to like it's like a 1970s fast food feel with just like the plastic counter, glam, whatever that counters are made out of. It's very stripped down. It's not all tricked out with like cool hipster sort of paraphernalia and design. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, it was semi-intentional, but I mean the goal of the first one was like, how cheap can we do this?
Yes, that's what it felt like in a good way.
And so
you went to the nice one.
Yeah, you did go to the nice one. We wanted a really utilitarian vibe. We wanted an old school bakery vibe. We didn't want any sort of pretension. The beautiful thing about Federal Donuts compared to our other restaurants is our customer base. It's like everyone. I mean, it's like every single walk.
Do you want
to
know why? Because everyone loves donuts.
Because everyone loves donuts.
And fried chicken.
Or fried chicken or coffee.
And or. Yeah. And coffee. Yeah. So it's like all the addictions.
So we just wanted people to be comfortable and not feel like they were coming into some place they didn't belong.
Yeah. And so was it a hit right out of the gate?
Yeah.
The press must have gone nuts, right? All the food bloggers and stuff.
We were overwhelmed after, I mean, we didn't have enough we didn't have enough chicken. When the line started for chicken the first day, we did not have enough chicken to even for like a quarter of the line. We had, and so Mike is out there. So we decided we're not going to sell anything today because we're just going to piss people off. We're just going to give everybody one piece of chicken until we're out. So Mike's out there handing out pieces of chicken. And we sort of took a lot of shit for running out of food early on.
But you must have known that like this is going to work, right?
I mean, the neighborhood was not, I mean, it was, I live in that neighborhood. It's not a neighborhood where you would open a restaurant that wanted to make money.
And yet, so how many do you have now?
Well, now we have four.
All in Philly. But you're opening, where else are you opening?
Someone leaked that we're opening in Nashville and Miami.
Miami, that's interesting, where everyone's all tan and skinny and stuff.
Yeah.
I think everybody, everybody likes a good donut, you know?
Yes.
And I think people also exercise a lot down there. So it's like all good.
Give and take. And when you're going to open a Federal Donuts in New York at some point, right? And is that just a rent thing? Like finding
just
the space?
A rent thing, yeah.
How do you, from a business standpoint, Steve, how do you do that math in terms of, obviously, I guess it's a pretty straight ahead equation in terms of what you pay and how many donuts a day you can sell?
Exactly. I mean, we like to think of rent as a percentage of sales. And when you're selling donuts for $1.50 or $2.50, that's a lot of donuts to make to make those numbers work. So we've had a little bit of trouble figuring that out in New York so far.
What about D.C.?
We like D.C. D.C. would make a lot of sense. I mean, we're already kind of here.
Here in
New York?
Yeah. You're literally here right now.
We're sitting in New York right now.
So you got a dizzying off in Chelsea Market. So if you're all right, if we have one property, we might as well have two because we're going to be coming up here on the Amtrak.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think New York has embraced us and been extremely warm and welcoming. And we, to be able to open a Federal here, I think would be awesome. I think people would get excited about it.
As partners, this has been written about, but there certainly is a precedent, a successful precedent for what you guys do. Whether you look at Joe Bastianich and Mario Batali, you look at someone like Jean-Georges and Phil Suarez, Bobby Flay and Lawrence Kretschmer, there's often the chef face and then the business partner to sort of power a successful relationship. Because it's one thing to be a talented chef. It's another thing to know how to run a business. What do you guys think the keys are to being successful and not driving each other crazy and actually sustaining a relationship?
I think driving each other crazy is kind of important.
There's some creative tension.
I don't know. We're really close, and we've been through a lot together, and we've definitely had – it's frustrating. I'll speak for Steve, and he'll – because that's what I do, yeah. Which really pisses him off. It's hard to – everyone is like, oh, you're the chef, you're the guy. And you're like, no. We've got a bunch of investors. We have like a huge team, some of which are now partners. Steve and I make just about every single decision together, including food.
Talk to me about the strengths of his palate and the weaknesses.
I would say all strong. I mean, I trust Steve's palate more than – it's hard. Palates are totally subjective or whatever, but Steve's got an amazing palate, and he's an amazing chef. You know, he doesn't work service, but he knows how to cook better than most people.
Yeah, like, so you guys are in sync on that front.
Well, we are, but it's also like, I don't know, we're okay with like telling each other that we think, what we think and what we think is right or what we think is wrong. And we also, I think we try to empower our team as much as humanly possible so they give us like decisions. Like I don't know. We have – so at Federal, we have five partners, right? And everybody kind of does different stuff. I think Steve has a bigger picture approach to like most of our restaurants because, for many reasons. One of the reasons is that I'm at Zahav like all the time, right? So
are you saying you're one of those chefs who cooks?
I mean, I'm getting old or whatever, and it's happening. I'm there a bunch, right? And it's like
I was there, you were by the oven, the fire wood
that's
fired
where,
oven.
That's where I like to be. And regardless of how big we get, that's kind of what I like to do. And like when we opened Abe Fisher, which is our like Ashkenazi restaurant, it's like Jewish food through Europe and America. He and our chef de cuisine Yehuda have a stronger background in European cooking and it was an American Jewish cooking. And it was something that like, I'm happy to like give my opinion or come up with ideas, but it's like Steve spent more time culinary wise, in addition to everything else, actually putting together Abe Fisher, So me rolling in there with like Chef White's pointing fingers is not what I feel comfortable doing. It's demeaning towards our chef Yehuda who embodies what it is that we're doing. And it's also takes away credit from what Steve does. So I think in the last couple years, we've really gotten better about navigating those things, but people still on the street are like, Mike, your restaurants are great. And I'm like, cool, do you want to meet Steve? He and I are equal freaking partners. Or if it's like the five of us from Federal Donuts, I'm like, I go in and eat free donuts and get coffee. When we opened, Steve and I made donuts. All the donuts that were served and all the chicken that was served was stuff that we prepped. So like I had a role then, but I work at night. And, it's always going to be like that to a certain degree. But I think we've gotten a little bit better, or people have gotten better. We've been more comfortable with, like, those awkward moments where people only come over to me, or if they're talking business, they're like, because basically they're like, Steve, you're the smart one.
You're the smart one. Like, you're that guy with a lot of tattoos on your arm.
Exactly.
So go back in the kitchen.
I wear t-shirts.
I think people have preconceptions. Mm-hmm. There's the paradigm. There's the chef business person. There's the front of the house, back of the house. And I mean, the reality is, like, we, as Mike said, we make most decisions together. Mike's instincts for business in particular are pretty extraordinary. And I think we get along because we both like to do the things that the other person doesn't like to do.
Yeah, what do you like to do?
I wouldn't say I like to sit in long meetings, but like that's like
but you can tolerate
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but I don't, what I don't like, what's not my strong suit, for example, is like talking to guests or, yeah, you know, and Mike enjoys that and he's great at it. But I'm just in general like a big fan of partners, because when I met Mike, I had opened a restaurant before that, and it was like the loneliest year of my life, and every problem, you know, every problem becomes magnified in your head when it's only you thinking about it. Every problem just becomes end of the world. And when you have a partner to bounce things off of, you have someone to, you have a, you know, a release valve. And I think that's what I mean, among the many things that I appreciate about working with Mike, it's just the ability to, you know, deal with problems together and not, you know, feel like every day is the end of the world.
Mike, you've talked a lot in the past about your struggles with drug usage and kind of getting over that, and yet you're in the restaurant business, which is a business where people work at night and so often go out afterwards, and like that, is that a challenge for you, or how do you sort of navigate those waters now?
You know, a lot of people think that because of the industry, the way that it is, the sort of dynamic that people have with like sort of being vampires a little bit, you know, you get into it because can swear, it's like high pressure, it's acceptable in some places to be totally banged up while you like work, when it's okay to like be out super late. I mean, I don't know. I don't really buy into that. I mean, I think that I don't want to use the word strict, but we don't like substances, and even like after dinner, like shift drinks, we don't really do that. We try to be as professional as possible. And the reality is, when I was using, I was by far the worst drug addict, the worst alcoholic in our kitchen, you know, but it just, I think that our team in general is not sort of focused around that. So even in like rehab, they were like, well, you're going to have to not be in the restaurant business. And I'm like, well, that's going to be a little bit difficult.
That's my job.
I know. I'm like, I wonder if the bank will be okay with me telling them that we have to sell it. Because it's just like, you know, you're not supposed to make any major changes in recovery. But I'm like, that's hard to do when you're like an owner of a restaurant or whatever. So I think that like in any profession, you know, you can take things really too far. I know plenty of professional people that are attorneys and bankers that also have, you know, substance abuse problems, and you just kind of learn to deal with it. And I think that, you know, I mean, in addition to being a great business partner, Steve, you know, Steve was there for me when things got super bad. And in addition to bouncing things, like when we opened Zahav, I went to rehab like a few months after. And it was also in 2008 when like the economy was falling apart. So it was like a major test. So
there is no good time for rehab. But you just got to do it.
You know, it's like you deal with problems. That's one of the things that I remember that Steve said, you know, we like figure out these, we come up with solutions to problems. Yeah. And it's like, it could be personal or it could be professional. And like, you know, we don't separate that much. Yeah.
It's interesting, but within at Zahav, for instance, you are able to create this ecosystem for yourself, and you're the boss, and you cultivate an environment. I think it seems to be more challenging though when you sort of leave that world. And we were talking about Feast Portland earlier, for instance, a food festival which we're partners at in Portland, Oregon, which is such a fun town. But if you're meeting up with a bunch of chefs tonight, they're drinking. Like you're going to Andy Ricker's bar, you're going to, you know, Dwayne Sorensen's bar, and like that's what chefs do. And it's like, is that a challenge to be in that sort of environment where everyone's socializing, but it's so in sort of revolving around alcohol?
I think that when you put it out there immediately and when you're comfortable, some people can't do it, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And they don't. I have been to those bars. I go to Pock Pock and hang out at and drink at Andy Ricker's bar all the time. I just have things that are non-alcoholic. Yeah. I'm still a crazy person that people think may be banged up. And that's like totally fine, you know? you know, I think that a lot of people have a hard time being honest about the way that they are. And it's like either black or white. Like I can work, I can be a chef, but or the industry is too difficult. And I just think that it's about preparing yourself for those situations, you know. Because it doesn't have to be like that. I know plenty of chefs that are awesome, that are good, that are sober, that are clean, and some that are struggling too. But I think it doesn't, you know, there's sort of no prejudice when it comes to addiction.
Yeah.
And everybody goes through it one way or another, and you can find yourself in a dark place in any industry whatsoever. And it's just really about sort of breaking that taboo thing. I mean, at first I thought it was weird because I'm like, what am I going to do with all my time? Or how could I possibly hang out with anybody? And it's like, I'm at every single after party talking to people. I'm usually driving them home, which is awesome. You know, and it takes a little bit longer to get warmed up on the dance floor, you know, when you're dead sober. But when everybody else is hammered around, you can do whatever you want. And you're still a better dancer than they are. So I just think... I think the more and more people are comfortable with it, the easier it is. And I've known a lot of people in the industry that have broken those sort of taboos.
That's very cool to hear. All right, so you guys have multiple restaurants now. You're opening Dizengoff here. You have a couple of Federal Donuts on the way. One challenge that faces so many restaurateurs like yourself is that, you know, when does it become too many? How do you manage that balance of always feeling like you need to have something new on the horizon while just being like, wow, we have way too much all of a sudden?
That's really difficult. I mean, I think when we were starting out, we couldn't get people to return our phone calls, and now it's you know, the problem is the reverse. It's like there's so many opportunities out there. How do you figure out how to say no? Because it's really tempting. But I think in the long term, you know, we're governed really by the quality of the people that we have to grow with. And if we don't have somebody that can, you know, move to New York, open a restaurant, make it through the very difficult opening months, then it's not going to be a good restaurant and we're not going to do it. I don't know. We talk about it a lot because we've got Dizengoff and Federal Donuts, which are...
Those both seem like ones so prime to open numerous.
There's plenty of opportunities.
Numerous of and still be good.
Yeah, and maybe it won't be quite as exciting for us coming up with new concepts and new things, but I think we're seeing a different kind of satisfaction in building something. So I think, you know, having those two things to focus on, I think, is going to be helpful in guiding us.
All right, guys, we're doing our lightning round. Either or questions. Yeast or cake?
Cake.
Yeah, cake.
Cake donut. Do you do yeast donuts at Federal?
We don't.
Wow. Not at all.
We do yeast donuts at Zahav. We make challah dough and we fry it for Hanukkah.
Whatchamacallits.
Sufganiyot.
Sufganiyot. Cheesesteaks or John's roast pork sandwich?
Roast pork.
I have a lot of people that I know that make good cheesesteaks.
Who makes, if I'm going to Philly and I want your best cheesesteak, where am I going?
I've got three options for you.
Okay.
And I'm going to put out Pat's because I think that I lived very close to Pat's and Gino's, and I have to say.
Which one Pat's is the angry one where it says you have to speak English to order?
Pat's is not that one.
Okay.
There's also something at Pat's called the large hot dog, which is three Hebrew national hot dogs deep fried on a hoagie roll with cheese whiz and hot sauce, which is nice if you're a little bit hungry. And then there's D'Alessandro's steaks, which is very good. And then there's Steve's Prince of Steaks. Very good in Northeast Philly. And there's also one on 16th Street. I still think John's roast pork is like pretty exceptional.
When you go to Pat's, what's your order?
Last time I was there, I got a large hot dog.
All right, but if you get the cheesesteak, how do you order? How do you take it?
At Pat's, I guess I would get cheese whiz and fried onions, and they have a bunch of pickled peppers. Mm-hmm. But D'Alessandro's, I do Prove I'll go American with onions and mushrooms. And then at Steve's, I actually get a pizza steak, which I don't normally like pizza steaks, but they're very good there. And John's roast pork is amazing, and they have tater tots.
And they make good cheesesteaks, too.
They do make very good cheesesteaks. Oh, you know what? Tony Luke's is also very good cheesesteaks.
Right. I need to get back to Philly.
For a guy that doesn't like cheesesteaks.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff, just mentioned
yeah, Tony
five
Luke's are really,
go
really, really
to.
Good, yeah.
Moses or Dr. J?
Oof, Dr. J.
Yeah, Dr. J.
Have you ever met him?
No, but the choke out with Larry Bird.
Oh, wow. I forgot all about that.
Yeah, dude.
Holy cow. I forgot all about that. Chicken question, boneless or bone-in?
Bone-in.
But yet you do the chicken sandwich.
Yeah, but we also fry bone-in chicken, too.
Thigh or breast, then?
I mean, I would say
Thigh.
Thigh, but like breast has its place as well. I'm not going to answer any of these questions straight.
Kebab or shawarma?
Kebab.
Kebab.
And what if you if we're going kebab, are you any particular meat of choice if you're in Israel?
I like Bulgarian and Romanian kebabs the best. And
which means what?
Which means they don't shoot them out. Like a lot of so kebab in Israel is ground meat.
Okay.
And usually Bulgarian is like lamb and beef with like tons of fat.
Uh-huh.
And they put a little bit of like either baking soda or club soda into it, so it like leavens and gets puffy. And because I think because it's a little bit like Balkan and European and less Middle Eastern, they don't cook it through, so it's still like a little medium. Very, very good. There's in Jaffa. There's a bunch of Bulgarian and Romanian restaurants because that was where everybody kind of immigrated to, and you can still find some of the old Balkan restaurants that are like amazing.
Very cool. Phillies or Flyers?
Phillies.
Yeah, actually, definitely this year, Phillies.
Depends who's doing better. Last question, butter or olive oil?
Olive oil, but butter is pretty awesome, but definitely olive oil.
I'll just say butter just to, just to irritate me.
The big joke at Sahab, they're like, chef, what's it need? Olive oil, lemon juice, and parsley? And I'm like, yeah, it does.
And a little salt.
Clock out and go home.
all right, guys, thanks for coming. And you can pick up your new book, not so newish, but award-winning Sahab cookbook, right?
Yeah, totally. Hit it up, Sahab cookbook, and get a little tchina. And you can direct
hummus.
And hummus and have some schug with that. And then you can direct message me on Instagram for cooking tips. And thank you so much for having us. And hopefully we'll see you in Philly and maybe in Tel Aviv, bro.
Yes. Let's
all
do
right?
that. What's that? Next year, next – well, I was saying next year in Jerusalem like we said past year, but next year in Tel Aviv.
Yep.
Switching it up. All right. Thanks guys.
A lot, bro.
This podcast has been brought to you by Belle Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mooj Zaidi and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday. – And if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.